my name is Tom Laker, and I'm a staff member at the Career Planning Placement Office. This is a program that, as far as I know, we have never done before. We're co-sponsoring it with Rackham. The idea of sort of what it means to be a faculty member as a panel really came from students at some of the other events that we had. As we would collect our student evaluations, which I'll have you fill out at the end of this program, one of the events that students talked about having was something that really gave faculty a chance to talk about issues of faculty culture, faculty roles, expectations of junior faculty, and how those expectations might change as a faculty member, progresses through a career, maybe some of the myths and or realities that graduate students had. Hearing from a lot of graduate students, they just didn't hear much from their advisors and other faculty members about what it really did mean to be a faculty member. So we decided to do this type of panel to start to address some of those kinds of issues, partly knowing that many of these issues are very specific to the individual student or also possibly very discipline specific. So I think that's one of the limitations that we sort of acknowledge going into something like this, is that we're hoping that the panelists can speak sort of as generally as possible, but also knowing that they will always speak from the framework of their own process that they went through. Let me just say a couple things sort of administratively before we get started. And one is to say up front that we were supposed to have three panelists today, but I got a call from Professor Rose from the History Department literally about an hour ago. She could hardly speak and said she was too ill to attend. But we're left with two very fine panelists. We'll have Farnam Jahanian from the EECS Department up in engineering, and also Professor Dickerson, Glenda Dickerson, who's also in the theater department and also an associate dean here at Rackham.
And is making her stage entrance.
On cue. We're just getting started.
Good.
And so the idea of this panel will be that both of the panelists will speak for some amount of time, 10, 15 minutes, potentially longer if you like, given that we're short one panelist today. I gave them some questions that they might want to think about along the lines as I was outlining earlier, but then also opening a question and answer, which I think is always very helpful in this type of setting. And so in just a minute, I will turn it over to them. I am going to pass around a couple things. The first is program evaluation. If you could take just a couple of minutes at the end of the program and fill that out. Again, it's the evaluations in past years that have led to events like this, so we really do take your feedback seriously. The other is just a clipboard. If you could also sign in, we like to keep a record of who attends these programs. It helps us to justify our existence for things like this. So I think that was all I wanted to say. I think maybe if the panelists want to come up now, we haven't talked about an order for who would like to go first, so you can flip a coin.
Can I ask a question before we get started?
Sure.
I was just wondering if you could raise your hands if you're here because you're not sure if you want to be a faculty member, that you might be interested in a non-academic career. Okay. Thank you.
So, would you like to start?
Well, I could. I hadn't thought of starting, but would you like to start?
I'll start.
Okay.
Give me a minute to get it. So I'll be brief. I prepared a couple of things to share with you before we get started, and really we should keep this a more of a dialogue, and I'm looking forward to answering some of your questions and share some thoughts with you. But I wanted to sort of set the stage for this discussion by telling you a little bit about who I am, and also give you a snapshot of my daily life as a faculty member here at U of M. And the best thing to do is essentially to start, first of all, by giving you my vital statistics. Let's see, this. As you can tell, I'm an engineer. I can't talk unless I start with a biograph. I have a PhD in computer science. I graduated from University of Texas at Austin in 1989. After finishing my graduate work, I joined the research division of IBM. And I was there for about 4 years, and then took a faculty position here at U of M in the College of Engineering, as Tom mentioned, in the Electrical Engineering and Computer Science Department. So if there's anything to be shared that's discipline specific, I guess I'll bring in the engineering perspective. Currently at Michigan, I have a research group that has, depending on how you count on a given day, 10 master's students and PhD students in it. By the way, how many of you are from the engineering college? Just curiosity. Oh, significant number. And I guess, how many from LSNA? How many, another question is, are there any undergraduates here? Are two, the rest of them graduates? Okay, that's good. Are also who are in my research group, who actively work in the research project, and a full-time program who's on staff. That's my academic life. I'm also married, and I have three kids. And that plays as big a role in my happiness and my health as much as my academic life. And it's very, very difficult to actually separate the two. So I'll be happy to answer questions about that aspect of it as well. That's a vital statistic. So as I was thinking and trying to come up with profound things to tell you about being a faculty member at Michigan, and I solicited input from some of my graduate students, who, by the way, were threatening to show up and challenge me on some of these things. None of them showed up. I decided that actually the best thing to do is to give you a snapshot of my daily life. What do I do during the day? In particular, in preparation for this, I took yesterday as a representative day, and also last Tuesday, partially because yesterday is a day that I didn't teach, and last Tuesday is a day that I actually teach. So here's Monday, 22nd of February, and that was yesterday morning. And this is what my, I don't know if you can see this in the back, this is what my day looked like. Not very glamorous, but there's some points to be made. At 9 o'clock every Monday morning, I have a research group meeting that's actually in Central Campus, interestingly enough, not in North Campus, that lasts till 10:30. Right after that, I rush to my office, answer email, put out a few fires, and in this case, I had a few minutes left, and I wrote a bunch of reference letters that were pending, and attempted to do that. I had about 45 minutes got that done. And then I had allocated myself an hour to finish editing this journal article that we've been working on and tried to put some finishing touches on it. And sure enough, at noon, right before I had to go to my lunch meeting, I realized that I wasn't done and I had more stuff to do. But there's no time left during the day, as you can tell, for me to get back to that point. By the way, you didn't tell me, are we supposed to talk them into becoming faculty members? I forgot to ask your advice on it. But nonetheless, let me continue, bear with me. Probably the most enjoyable part of it was I had a lunch meeting, which I usually do. Almost every day of the week I have lunch meetings, and often it's with my graduate students, who are on my research group, two or three of them at a time that are working on a project. Right after that, I had a review of a defense talk by one of my graduate students who's going to do her defense in a couple of weeks. She's actually doing her interview jobs, going through an interview process right now. After that, I have about an hour that I have a TA meeting, as well as I do course preparation for my lecture on Tuesday. Right after that, there was a software seminar that we run every Monday, and usually during this time of year, we have faculty candidates come through. I went and attended that. The reason for that is because I had to have dinner with that faculty candidate, so I had to attend the talk, at least. I also serve on the search committee, so it was important to do that. I had 15, 20 minutes right after that. I answered a few phone calls and answered my email. At 5 to 6, I had another research meeting with a couple of my graduate students. And then around 6:15, I rushed and had dinner with our department head and our faculty candidate who was visiting. And I'll get to the last part of the day, which starts around 10 p.m. But earlier during the day, you see there are a bunch of arrows. And I tried to accurately highlight different places during the day where a very high priority, urgent thing came up that sort of distracted me from whatever I was doing that morning. And I counted three of them that came up yesterday. That's a bit unusual. But one of them actually was a realization at about 2:30 that my wife had just returned from out of town and I had forgotten to tell her that I was having dinner with this faculty candidate. And I got on the phone and I called her up and I said, I think I mentioned this to you, but I may have forgotten. And she said, yep, you sure did. And that was the end of that. So that was a non-teaching day. And then I wanted to share with you, today was going to be a bit difficult, so I picked last Tuesday and I took some notes on it. on what I did on Tuesday the 17th. Again, I showed up, I answered my email. Being a computer scientist, a lot of my work actually gets done through email during the day and the evening. And I usually have an hour that I prepare for this class. This is a course that I've taught many times, so preparation is not a whole lot. I went and gave my lecture. Usually, I spend about 30 minutes right after lecture handling questions. This is a very large undergraduate class. I have about 120 or 130 students in this class. It's a senior level undergraduate class. And then I have my meeting with my graduate students. I'm a director of the software lab in AECS department. I had some software lab related administrative issues, and as well as a principal investigator meeting coming up. As part of a research grant that we have, we go to these meetings of principal investigators for this program that's funded by the Department of Defense, and we have to take some presentation and posters, and I had a meeting to go over our posters, see how it looked. And then also, at the end of last week, I had a program committee meeting on Friday, and I had read some of the papers, and I typed in some of the reviews for these papers. And I'm sure that's true of in other disciplines as well, where there's peer review of published papers. And then finally, I held my office hours, and I had some more meetings with my graduate students, and this is a joint project with Honeywell. And then at around 6 to 6:30, all the E's have dropped from this for some reason. I answered my email and I attempted to leave my office. Usually that's what my day looks like. And I have a bunch of R's and W's in here. And late at night, I tend to do a lot of reading, a lot of writing, some more reading, some more writing. But R also stands for relaxing, and W also stands for watching television. So it's a combination of various things. I don't remember if there were any high priority interrupts that came during the day on Tuesday of last week, but I'm sure there were a few of them and I just neglected to highlight them. So a couple of things to point out. And I'll try to wrap this up actually and get to questions after you share some of your thoughts with us. I tried not to come up with 20 or 30 different bullets that sort of captured all of my thoughts about what it means to be a faculty member. I wrote down about 20 or 30 different things, and I said, okay, what are the most three important things that I wanted to share with you as far as life being a faculty member? One thing is, which I think it's the challenge and what really attracted me to come to an academic environment from industry. And I think I'm in a pretty good position to share my views with you on what it takes to succeed in an industrial environment, an industrial research lab, as well as an academic environment. And I know that's not applicable to all disciplines. The intellectual freedom and for an engineer or a scientist such as myself, the realization that in fact you are to a large extent, in control of your research destiny, the work that you do, the research contributions that you make. And that's a very positive aspect of being in an academic environment, that the intellectual freedom and the ability to essentially pursue a lot of speculative things from a research point of view. And there's not a day that goes by. In fact, if you go and look at all of the research meetings that I have with my graduate students, for example, there's not a day that goes by, and I demand that of my graduate students, that almost every day when I meet with them, I learn something from them. And that's really, really important to me as an academic, as a faculty member. I often, as my graduate students sort of join my group and we work together and so on, the relationship of feeding them information in one direction sort of gradually goes down, where it gets to a point where I learn a good deal from them and through them. And that's a very attractive aspect of being in an academic environment. Another interesting aspect of it is that although you're in charge, you can't let it get out of hand. Sure, you're the chief executive officer, and you're the chief financial officer, and you're the chief information officer, and you're the chief scientist, and the chief recruiter, the chief lobbyist, head of the sales department, And it goes on and on, and you're the chef, and then you're the waiter, and you're the waitress or the waiter, and you're the busboy, and everything. As far as the group is concerned, as far as this research activity is concerned. So although you have tremendous amount of leverage in pursuing sort of this intellectual exercise, but at the same time, there's tremendous amount of responsibility on a faculty member in terms of the kind of activities that we're responsible for. And in a company, for example, it's very different. Things tend to be much, much more hierarchical, and division of labor seems to be a lot more clear, at least from my perspective. The second point that I wanted to share with you, and this probably is not true across all disciplines, at least I can say in much of engineering it's true, certainly much of computer science where I belong is true, is that my day really does require the ability to switch context from one topic to another topic very quickly and very fast and fairly frequently. And that really does require a person who's going to succeed in the job, at least in the kind of work that I do, the ability to shift focus from one aspect of our research to another aspect, to teaching, to dealing with, say, service or administrative issues, and so on and so on. And I noticed that to be much more widespread and much more frequent in my position as a faculty member in a college engineering than I had noticed actually being in an industrial research lab. I found it to be somewhat of a more sheltered life in being in a research lab. Finally, I know many of you go into or choose to go and pursue an academic career, partially because of the research you do, that interest that you do in research. And I won't hide from you the fact that, and I know many of you know this, you're a graduate student here, that University of Michigan, to a large extent, is a research institution. We do have teaching responsibility. I think we do a very good job of it. But research is really, really important. And faculty members who are in many of our academic units are expected to excel in research and be the best in their disciplines, and that's expected. But I can't emphasize the importance, having been both on the industry side and the teaching side, I can't emphasize that you really should not go into an academic environment. As much as you enjoy research, as much as you believe that in fact the work that you're doing, whether you're in history or you're in psychology or in computer science or other areas of engineering, you should not go into and pursue an academic career unless you truly enjoy teaching. And by teaching, I don't really mean just getting in front of people and lecturing for an hour and a half in a classroom. Far from it. You enjoy teaching and you enjoy mentoring students. And the best sort of way that I can share that with you from my own experience is probably the most enjoyable part of my job, from all the things that I do during the day, is the part that I interact with the undergraduate students when I teach them in classes and talk to them, and also my direct interaction with my graduate students, my research students. These two are by far the most enjoyable aspects of the job. And if you don't enjoy that, you really should not be in an academic environment, regardless of how good you are in your research. You should pursue a different career. Go to a research lab, go to a company, go do something else. And I think that's a point that I want to make, that do not underestimate, and I know many of our academic units are very, very strong in research. We should not underestimate the importance of commitment to teaching and mentoring students, both at the undergraduate level and graduate level, as faculty members. I stop at this point in time and turn it to you.
Again, my name is Glenda Dickerson, and I wanted to ask how many of you, if any of you, are artists? What department are you in?
I'm in
I'm in English.
And what kind of art do you practice?
Direct plays and white poetry.
Fabulous. Okay, so is it, what's your name?
Andrew.
Is Andrew the only one then?
If we like to dance, does that count?
Yes, that counts.
Okay.
And what about, is there anyone else here who's in English? Who writes or directs or paints or... So what, are you all thinkers? Is that what you are predominantly? Tell me some of the departments that you're in, some of your interests.
Economics.
Mm-hmm. And you? In the red?
Mechanical.
Mechanical. And you?
Chemistry.
Chemistry. And you on the floor?
Pharmaceutics.
Uh-huh. And you in the blue shirt and the glasses?
Overcome.
Uh-huh. And you?
Chemistry.
Okay. One more. All the way back there in the back in the beige cable knit sweater.
In material science and engineering.
In materials. Okay, so my discipline is theater, as you may have heard. I write plays, I direct plays, I make plays, I make projects, I make big community projects out of non-dramatic sources, and I make them into dramatic events. So you would say, well, our interests couldn't be farther apart. That's what you would think. And if you look at the books and where I am published, which are very different from my colleague, one book is called Colored Contradictions. And the other book is called Contemporary Plays by Women of Color. I have plays in both of these books. You would never, if you came across these books in a bookstore, I bet you wouldn't pick it up. You wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't be of any interest to you. And you'd never think that something that said Colored Contradictions would have an impact on your life, but it does. And do you know why? Because we are both teachers. We are both faculty members. And we are here today in the same room trading intellectual currency. Whereas in another life, our paths would never cross. And I say to you that our lives, mine and yours, are richer for the fact that our paths cross here today. So whether you become a faculty member or not, of course, it's a question for you to answer. But I want to tell you what being a faculty member means to me. And in order to do that, I have to tell you a little bit about the work I do and how I do it and show you how it has an impact on the work you will do if you become a teacher, an educator, a member of a faculty, a part of an academic community. I teach acting, as I told you. And when you teach a person acting, you have to find a way to go into that person's mind and animate what we call the inner image. You have to find a way to release that person's imagination, to employ her inner life, her history, her imagination. And that's a gift. Not everybody can do it, you know? Not everybody can animate that inner image. And so I've worked at it all my life, and I've become very good at it. I really am a master acting teacher and a master director, and I have tremendous results. But you know why that is, primarily? It's because I am interested in the answers to my questions. I'm not asking questions for any kind, for a result. I'm asking because I want to know the answer. And so when I say to an actor, who's playing, does everybody know James Baldwin? Yes? Sure, right? No? Okay, so who's James Baldwin, my sister? Okay, so somebody who's familiar with James Baldwin, tell me who that is. Anybody? Yes?
Political thinker, writer, commentator.
Can you tell me something that he wrote?
Giovanni's Room.
Yes.
The
fire next time, go tell it on the mountain. Yeah, he was like, when he died, I was at his funeral at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City. And Amiri Baraka, who I'm sure everyone knows, Mr. Dorsey, you know who that is, don't you? Does everybody know who Amiri Baraka is? Okay, so Mr. Dorsey, speak to us a little bit about Amiri Baraka.
Amiri Baraka, formerly known as Leroy Jones, was another black
writer, poet.
Poet, essayist, playwright.
Playwright, all of those things.
Thinker, yeah, he was
and, a... And a revolutionary
And a
thinker.
Revolutionary thinker, yeah, that's the best way, one of the best ways. At James Baldwin's funeral, James Baldwin, who preached the eulogy, said he called him God's revolutionary black tongue. That's what he called James Baldwin. And that's the best best example, you know, that I've ever heard of. But say we were looking at Richard and James Baldwin's play, Blues to Mr. Charlie, who is a drug addict. And they send him from the upper, you know, from the hell of urban America, down to the South to be with his grandmother and heal himself. And of course, he's lynched down there and killed. It's a horrible story. It's a story, actually, of Emmett Till. It's based on an historical person. And so anyway, that's the play. So if I'm trying to direct someone to play the role of Richard, then it's not enough for me to say, well, how does a junkie act? You see what I'm saying? You know, what does it feel like to be in withdrawal from heroin? It's not sufficient to ask that question. The question that I have to ask is, how do you feel when you need something desperately and you can't have it? And then it's not enough to just ask the question. You have to plumb the actor for the answer. Because they're going to say something superficial at first. Can't you see why? Who wants to be on the spot, you know, exposing themselves? So they're going to say something superficial, but you keep plumbing and plumbing and plumbing until finally something unlocks in that person. And you see it. The planes of their face change. The eyes might tear up or look far away. You see it when it happens. It happens every time. And it's magical. It's the same thing that I look for when I'm teaching my students. It's the same thing. You know, I was taught by the empty vessel to be filled method. Does everybody know what that is? Somebody tell me what that is. Who wants to tell me what they think that is?
Non-interactive teaching.
Huh?
Non-interactive teaching.
Non-interactive teaching, yes.
One way.
Exactly. You know what I thought you said? You said non-interactive teaching, right? You know what I thought you said? I thought you said no one talks but the teacher. It's the same thing, though, isn't it? Is it the same thing? Yeah. So that's how I was taught. And there are some things that I learned, like, really, really well that way, and there's some things I learned it. I just didn't learn until much later in my life. So in studying, I was a Lilly fellow, a Lilly teaching fellow in my career, and, you know, many other things, and I learned this questioning method. This questioning method. So that you ask a student a question. And the trick is to value the answer. To value the answer, because it's easy to pretend to ask questions. That's easy. You know, what's your name in the yellow sweater?
Dunry.
So it's easy for me to say, well, Dunry, what do you think about what I just said? But I don't care what she thinks. All I want is to her to say something so I can pretend to have asked her a question so I can then keep on talking some more. But the trick is to value the answer to the question, to want to understand what is going on in Dunry's mind, just as my colleague said, to understand what is going on in Dunry's mind and really how I impact her. You know, it's very frightening when you first start having students write back to you. You know, that was one of the methods we learned as Lilly teaching fellows. You know, that you have them write back to you. Well, how'd you think class went today? Well, what would you like to do more of? You know, what would you like to do? It's very frightening. But if you can just kind of gird your courage, then you find it's a very valuable, you know, exchange. And I'm taking the time to tell you about the questioning method because if you don't love students, if you don't love the idea of interacting with a thirsty mind, then being a faculty member, as my colleague says, is not for you. But I tell you that there is nothing more rewarding when you have spent a life of study. Some of you have been in here, what, 8 years? You know, you've spent a life of study. You've spent a life saturating your mind with an expertise that only you possess. And there is nothing greater, there's no more wonderful feeling in the world
to be able to ignite a fire in somebody coming behind you with what you have going on in your mind. To me, that's all the teaching is. That's all the teaching is. And I have integrated being a faculty member into my professional life, which is what I hope you will do. If you don't want to be, you know, if you don't want to be a tenured professor, you know, I hope that you will find a way to integrate teaching into your professional life. That's how I first got on tenure track. I stumbled onto it. See, don't be ignorant like I was. That's why you're so lucky to have these workshops like you're having. Because I just stumbled into a tenure track position. I didn't even know what it was. I just knew I had a job for 3 years to support me while I, you know, directed plays, which pays no money. And so then when that tenure track position was up, you know, that one didn't work out because I didn't know what I was doing. I was just going and teaching my classes, thought I was doing a good job, and then that didn't work out, and then I went to another one, and, you know, then it was time to come up for tenure. No one had told me how to prepare my portfolio. No one had told me how to insist that my creative work be evaluated differently than your scholarly work is. These are all the things that I didn't know when I was coming through 25 years ago. And these are all the things that you know now. You see, these are the things that Rackham takes out time to make sure you have this information. I can't tell you how valuable that is. And I can't tell you what it means for minds across disciplines to be able to meet. You're not gonna have that anywhere else than in the academy. Minds across disciplines, wide expanses of disciplines. And it makes you a richer person, it makes you a fuller person, it makes you a warmer person, it makes you a better person, and I think ultimately it makes it a better world. So whatever you decide to do with your fine minds and this wonderful education that you have been given here in this institution, I hope that you will consider utilizing part of your energy to teach, to give back, to pass on. So I'll stop there, and I hope we can have some questions. Thank you.
I'd like to start with a question to Professor Dickinson. I know that you taught at Spelman before coming to the University of Michigan. I was wondering if you could comment on the differences of teaching at a small school versus a research university.
Right. Well, I started out at Howard University, which is a small African, well, it's not so small, it's a university, but it's small compared to here. It's an African American institution. That was kind of my first job. And then I spent the rest of my career at the State University of New York, which is a large institution, the State University of New Jersey, which is a large institution. And I went from those places to Spelman College, which is a small African American women's college in Atlanta, Georgia. The president was Janetta Cole, who some of you may even have seen or know of. You know, they call her America's sister president. She was a remarkable woman. And she took Spelman from this little colored girls college, you know, missionary college, to this major institution that was known all over the world. It was just remarkable how in 10 years she transformed the face of that institution. But it was so small. And there were no graduate, you know, classes. There were no graduate students. And so the difference is that when you talk about interdisciplinarity at Spelman, you're talking about two people who are willing to work with you outside of their own discipline. And it's very, very hard to, even between theater and women's studies, which is, you know, one of my real interests, it's very hard to get the women's studies department to kind of collaborate with me on some of the big projects that I wanted to do, that I was used to being able to accomplish from working in universities, you know, like big, huge conferences and symposia and where you bring this one and that one. They just didn't, you know, they just didn't see it. They were very insular in that respect. And when I left Spelman and came here, I don't know, it was like, I don't even know how to explain it to you. First of all, there's the sense of being overwhelmed because it is so large, and there's a sense of so much wealth, you know, the wealth of, not, I don't mean financial wealth, the wealth of every time you turn around, you're meeting another wonderful person and finding out there's a whole department that does this over here, and oh my God, there's an institution that does that, and so you can't, you know, you can't take it all in. But this is my second year, and then you begin to realize that what makes this, and I've thought about this a lot, What makes this institution and an institution of this size so powerful an experience is that there is anything you want to do, you can do it. There is going to be not one person, but five on this campus. Anything you can think up, there are going to be five people you can find who are going to want to collaborate with you on it. And I don't, you know, not even just close to your own disciplines, I mean way across disciplines. And that's what I think is the primary difference. For a person who wants to stay in her lab, or a person who wants to stay in his department, you know, you can go almost anywhere. But if you want to think to the future, if you want to be prepared for the millennium, if you want to think globally, then you want to come to a huge research institution like this.
Yes?
Some questions for you.
Sure.
Sorry, I don't remember your name.
Farnham? Yes.
Number one, can you talk more about what your evenings are like?
Sure.
Number two.
And weekends.
Evenings and weekends, that would be good. Number two, when do you get the large blocks of time where you can get things done? I mean, I see all these hour-long things, and I know in my experience, that doesn't work to get really major new things done. And three, do you really write references for people in half an hour?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I can whip them out. Believe it or not, no, actually, it takes longer than that. It often actually that particular thing was that I wrote a bunch of recommendation letters for several of our undergraduates who are in our honor society, and for some reason this batch did not make it. This was all to UCLA, and that morning I essentially went back and retrieved my files and I printed them. And I made copies of, fortunately I had copies of the form letter itself, and essentially regenerated those and sent them out. So, no, recommendation letters often take much longer, particularly for graduate students. So, what are my evenings like? Actually, Jane London, who's a neighbor, and her son and my son play, can testify to this. Your experiences will vary depending on the faculty member. I have colleagues, for example, who are single and brand new to the department and so on. And I know many of them, they still, you know, lead a graduate student life in some ways. You know, they go and eat something, they come back to their office, they work some more and so on. I fortunately live close enough to my office where I can do that. However, I do have three young children. So as a rule, I try to get home at a decent hour so we have meals and then play with my kids. And my wife and I make an honest attempt to get them to bed by 9 o'clock, which I think it's a record for our neighborhood, I think. Usually till about 9:30, it's primarily consumed by, you know, spending time with family, eating a meal, and hanging around with the kids. And of course, it really varies. Some evenings I decide, especially if there's something I'm working on, writing a proposal, writing a paper, I may just work on my laptop and continue from, you know, 10 p.m. to later. There are other nights that I don't do anything. I just, you know, my wife and I hang around, we talk, we read, we watch television. If I had to sort of take a guess, I would say at least a couple of nights a week I'm working after going home, after the kids are in bed. The weekends are also kind of similar. I do tend to work a little bit on weekends. In general, a couple of hours at least on Saturdays, sometimes more, I attempt to do some work at home. And that's all done trying to schedule it around my kids, essentially, and my wife, so that we have some family time on weekend, of course, on weekends. I have tried, actually, to minimize the amount of work that I do at home on weekends. But the truth is, a lot of times I can essentially read a paper, a lot of times if I'm reading someone's dissertation draft and so on. Those are the things that I can do at home, and it's fairly manageable.
What is your subject area?
It's called Geoscience and Remote Sensing. It's a combination of the Electrical Engineering Department and Atmospheric, Oceanic, and Space Science Department.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to do with applying the information gathered by satellites that are orbiting the Earth, and applying the information, understanding how the Earth works as a system.
Mm-hmm.
So it deals with climate change and things seems like that.
So when you ask about a long chunk of time, are you thinking of time to research or to write or?
For example, I need to write a paper for an upcoming conference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's most convenient. Well, it's going to get done the best and fastest if I can do it in long chunks of time instead of trying to work on it
an hour here
and
an hour there. Sure, right.
So, you know, I talked with my advisor about that too, and it's kind of the never-ending search to find these 3 or 4 hour chunks of time. When do you find
it? You're absolutely right. So I've done it in two different ways, and I'm not exactly proud of it. The first way is and that works out actually fairly well. There are days like on Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays that I will block an afternoon, and I don't respond to my phone, I don't respond to my email. Often actually what I do is I go and hide in one of my labs and work. and it works great. Because if you're in your office, and I try to be accessible, people will find you.
Oh, sure.
And there's always a knock on the door. And it's not by the students, as it turns out. I get interrupted more often by my colleagues than anyone else. Or somebody, you know, needs something and remembered that, oh, they had to get a hold of me. Often it turns out that if you ignore them and don't answer your colleagues and so on for a while, they go away. And the thing will take care of itself and you don't have to worry about it. So the other lessons that I've learned is that, in fact, I filter my email, and some of my email, I don't respond to them within the first 24 hours. And remarkably, many of those urgent things also
go away.
And it's great.
Sure.
That's one method that's worked out fairly well. So I do, and I fully agree with you, that I could not work on a paper or do some thinking or do some of the research just spending an hour or so on it. It really has to be a longer chunk of time. There have been other times that I've allocated on an afternoon on weekends where I have gone in and worked on it. And that's the part that I'm least proud of, actually. But I've done that on numerous occasions, and I continue to do it, and it works out okay.
Well, I think, too, that there's also another way to think about structuring a day and a week. A day doesn't have to be divided up into hours and two-hour slots. And I think... Are other people interested in this question, or should, is it a pretty general? It seems like something. Yeah, that's one of the things when you first are interviewing for a new faculty position. That's one of the really important things to ask. What does my schedule look like? How many days a week do I have to teach? How many hours do I have to spend in advising? You know, those are very important questions for you to ask so that you understand, you know, what a week looks like for you. And if you can negotiate so that you're only teaching 3 days a week, which is, you know, very possible, then you might have to spend that fourth day advising students, you know, office hours, answering emails. But that fifth day, you could carve that day out for yourself, and that day could be a Friday or it could be a Monday. And then if you could string together your week, and see, then that gives you a 3-day chunk when you can actually do your work. So it's up to you how to structure your week depending on your discipline, how to structure, you know, your day. You could spend a day that, you know, depending on, you know, family requirements and so on. You can spend a day that goes from 9 to 9 or 9 to midnight to secure 6 hours for yourself, you know, on the second day.
Often, though, when I had a lot of numerous hours on my schedule, that's it, meeting with research students. What I found out is that, unless we're working on a paper, for example, often an hour is a reasonable amount of time to give feedback and essentially find out what's going on and work through some of the details. One of the things that we attempt to do in my group is essentially to avoid having long, drawn meetings
mm-hmm.
that don't lead to anything. So usually an hour time limit works out really well. And it sort of forces a discipline on us to be much more productive during that 1 hour. But there's no doubt, I fully agree with you. There are times that you just essentially have to set it aside and say, I'm just going to go work on this for the next 4 or 5 hours. You know, brainstorming on something, writing a paper, and so on.
Did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I'm in environmental education, and I want to teach worse than anything in the world. And maybe it's just a perception problem on my part, but I have a real hard time kind of with that kind of a snapshot of a day. I'd really like to have my days pretty much the other way around, that like all the time that you get to spend mentoring, I wouldn't mind being in the classroom or maybe mentoring small projects or whatever, even for undergrads. But the research meetings and the amount that if you are going to actually get tenured and actually get to keep a job somewhere, I'm told by all sorts of folks, then negotiate not to have a 3 or 4 course teaching load. I wouldn't mind doing that, but I don't get the idea that I'm ever going to be able to keep a job. So how do we do what you say in terms of getting creative work or community service or community research or extension education, like where you maybe take the learning from the university somewhere out in the community where it's needed and give back? How do we get that evaluated, like scholarship? I'm not saying I'm going to quit doing research or quit writing, but instead of 2 books a year or whatever it is, I get to say that my day is another way and I get to keep a job.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, you know, one of the things that I wanted to say in my remarks that I didn't say is, you know, one of the most important pieces of advice I could give you as a young faculty, prospective faculty member, is to try to attach yourself to an institution that has a mentoring system in place, and that that the department even formally pairs you with a senior faculty member who will mentor you through some of those very tricky questions. Because I think, you know, this is one of the more supportive institutions that I've worked in. You know, I've worked in a lot of institutions where you're really just thrown out there, you're just really on your own. And that's when junior faculty members are really at risk. You know, they can't win for losing, just as you're saying. You know, you've got to get your research done, you've got to keep publishing, you know. You have to sublimate sometimes your real interest, which is to extend what you're doing out into the community. So I would say 2 things to you. I would say one is the match. You know, find the right institution for you. But once you find that institution that you like, you must have a senior faculty member to mentor you, because there is a way to balance all of those things, and there is a way to have value placed on some of these non-traditional things. Not even really non-traditional, but you know, that you value. There's a way to have them weighted and valued and so on. You know, because you can imagine with me coming through, I didn't have a PhD. You know, I didn't publish. You know, my creative work was my research. But I was in a state university and they didn't know what that meant. I was way back then when we had to fight not to have to publish in order to get tenure. You know. So I know what that battle looks like, and I know that there's been a lot of progress made, and I just think you can have the academic life that you want. I know that you can. It's finding the right match. I think he had a question.
I don't know if you're tenured or are you?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not sure when you were up for tenure, maybe the transition was easier for you because you worked in industry. But I feel like the schedule you explained over the day, well, that's fine, but nice that you can relax and everything. You did the same thing when you were up for tenure, or, you know, when you were on tenure.
Sure. So what did my schedule look like when I was before tenure? I think I need to have my wife here to answer. To give me an eye. So I came on a shorter tenure cycle because I came from a research lab. So that my experience is somewhat biased. So I came in having a good bit of experience, particularly in terms of the research I wanted to do and so on. And that experience is not directly comparable to junior faculty members that start. At the same time, as quickly as I entered, although I was untenured, in our lab, suddenly a lot of the burden fell on my shoulder, because the expectation was that I was going to get tenured very quickly, and people started forgetting that I was not a tenured faculty. Mm. And that was, you know, everybody acknowledges that was somewhat unfortunate, but that was just the you know, circumstances. So very quickly, many of the senior professors in other areas that depended on our lab and so on approached me, and I became sort of the unofficial spokesperson from the software area for a lot of things, including graduate student recruiting, faculty search, and so on and so on. And partially because there was a need in our area for somebody to fill that position. So my days were filled, I had bigger chunks of time that I was that I was able to essentially to allocate to do research. Because first of all, I had fewer graduate students. I had less funding, thank God, at the time. So you didn't have to worry about as much managing the thing. And I took one, particularly for those of you who are engineering students, I say the best way to succeed is to be very focused, from a research point of view, to be very focused in your research when you start. There is a temptation among engineering students that when you start as a junior faculty member, there are so many other people that you can work with. Mm-hmm. And that's exciting, and you know, we all want to do that. But the problem with that is that as soon as you start getting involved in a bunch of different things, you will have less and less meaningful time that you can devote to one or two things that would flourish and develop into something much more significant. So I made the conscious decision, although I was being approached by a lot of faculty members for joint work and so on, to be very focused in a couple of things that I pursued. And I resisted the temptation of actually getting involved in too many things. Mm-hmm. I can no longer say that I am doing that. I'm doing a lot more, you know, various kinds of things that I didn't used to do when I entered. But I think that helped a lot. That meant that I was much more deliberate in the kind of research that I got involved in. And I was much, much more careful not to jump into new projects and so on, get involved in things. Mm-hmm. I worked as hard as I do now. I don't think my workload has gone down. Same way that I do it now, in the evenings, a lot of times I continue to work and publish and so on. I think I worked a lot more on weekends during the first 2-3 years while I was going through the tenure process. And I know that I did. I spent a lot more time on weekends. Partially, I just couldn't do everything I wanted to do during the weekdays. As it turned out, as my research became more successful and the project started taking off and so on, in some ways, one of the things that's been really helpful is being able to define projects where there are 2 or 3 graduate students involved. and that has reduced the effort that I'm putting into starting new things. I have 2 or 3 things that are ongoing. And for that reason, I'm not spending as much time as I did when I was starting trying to get these things successful and trying to get them off ground. Mm-hmm. They're sort of ongoing, we're developing new things and so on, but that initial overhead of getting things going is not there. Does that answer your question? I probably worked on weekends a lot more.
The problem comes from...
But could we keep the dialogue going? We have another question over here.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Shifting to a different topic, actually.
Please.
I was wondering if you might be able to give some suggestions for someone, some graduate students like me, who don't get an opportunity to teach while they're in graduate school, but think that they might like it, think they want to be a faculty member. You know, what can you suggest to explore those ideas?
Mm-hmm. What is your background? Mm-hmm. Which department are you in?
I'm in the Department of Health Management and Policy in the School of Public Health.
And why is it that you don't have the opportunity to teach?
They don't have TA positions for most. It's a master. It's a professional school. Most of the courses are taught by the professors and graded and evaluated. Students are graded and evaluated by the professors rather than by TAs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they have some gradership positions, but no TA positions.
Do you have any thoughts on that? I had a suggestion for you. One way to do this, and I encourage all of my students, graduate students, are funded as research assistants or fellowships. So they also have the similar concern, which is for them it becomes a choice of, before joining my group, if they were a TA, great. If they weren't, after they join my group, they really don't have an opportunity to be a TA because the choice becomes, making a lot of progress in their research or essentially stopping their research or slowing it down and spending a semester TAing. Any one of my graduate students that comes to me and says they have interest in joining an academic environment, I encourage them to do it, and I encourage them to do it actually later in their graduate career as opposed to earlier in their graduate career. I think they're actually become better teachers, they're much more self-confident, and it doesn't become like a chore. They don't have any more coursework. That's really a great time to get them to do it. So they can actually make some progress on their research, but at the same time, they can spend a semester, and I encourage them to do it. In your case, my suggestion is to look at community colleges in the area to see if there's an opportunity, because some of the community colleges do approach our graduate students to come in and help in teaching. And if you can get, for example, Washtenaw Community College, if you're willing to go a little farther, you know, somewhere around Detroit, closer to Detroit, to see if any of the community colleges, particularly if you're a senior graduate student, would be interested in having you be an instructor. Mm-hmm. And I think you're being very wise in trying to get some teaching experience before making that decision.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I've worked with students who have also taught, picked up courses at four-year colleges. I worked with a student who taught a summer course at Kalamazoo College, for example. So I think community college is one, but it wouldn't have to be limited to that either, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in my case, I don't want to have a tenure position or something. I want to stay here after I get my PhD degree for like 2 years or something, just to have the experience and then go back to my country,
which is
Brazil. Mm-hmm. And I would like to know if you think what kind of positions, if it's available or not. If
what's your area?
I mean, computer information systems in the business school.
Okay, CIS.
CIS. Mm-hmm. And I have another question related to this, is about postdoc. Mm-hmm. What are you expected to do really in a postdoctoral program position?
Generally speaking?
Yeah.
I want to look at the first part of your question. You said that your preference would be to stay here at the university for another couple of years after
or
you...
Or another university.
Uh-huh. Oh, so
working, teaching...
Or stay in this country.
Yes.
2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
I see, before you go back to Brazil.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, I think, postdocs, vary, depending on the institution and on the, on the subject matter. Some of them will provide you with the opportunity, just to do concentrated research for the time of the postdoc, and others will expect you to function something like an assistant professor. So again, it just depends on the institution, but it's a wonderful opportunity for you to, move to that next step before you take the plunge of getting on a tenure track line. It's a wonderful opportunity. They have a situation here at this university called the College of Fellows, Jane? What is it?
You're on your own glass.
Okay. I just heard about it today. That's why it's fresh on my mind, because I have to go sit on a committee, I found out, to evaluate applications for the Distinguished Fellow, Distinguished Dissertation. But this is a College of Fellows. It's like a postdoc, and students come from all over, and there are 12 of them, I think, each. I think she said there were 12 of them each year. There are 12 continuing ones, so I guess there are more all the time, because they could come every year. But, that's right here. You might look into that. That's a Rackham... has something to do with the right. I think I'm pretty sure it's called the College of Fellows. You can speak with Glenda Haskell. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk about a little bit about the sort of politics of teaching and how you have to balance between personal issues, agendas, kind of departmental issues, especially when developing course content or
mm-hmm.
teaching styles, that kind of stuff.
Yes.
And how you sort of mediate between all these different things that
yes.
are trying to...
Yeah, it's really, it's a real challenge. And the first challenge is that, teaching is so hard. This is what I really... so many graduate students are just kind of thrown out there and, put on tenure track lines or whatever and expected to be teachers. Where do you learn that? You learn through observation. And if you don't observe a good teacher, then, there's no reason that you're going to be a good teacher. So that's the first challenge. You're trying to find your way. You're trying to find your style. You're trying to, get your courage up and not be intimidated, by these 30 open faces looking, looking to you to know everything. So you have to balance, like all of that stuff. So I think in terms of the politics of the situation, here's one good thing about the academy. even though we tell all of these horrible, you know, these horror stories about, you know, the poor untenured faculty, you know, the junior faculty, and they're so at risk, you know, which is true, of course. But, you know, the other side of that is that you really are someplace where it is really hard for you to lose your job for holding an unpopular opinion. You know, it's not like the corporate world in that sense. And, you know, they really do take the, you know, your First Amendment rights seriously. So that, you know, if you are, if you are prepared, if you can, you know, support what you are doing in the classroom, and if you believe in a style which you have built up, you know, for yourself, then I don't think that you have to, you know, but now here's what they do in one department I know, which I won't mention any names, but there's a real split between the practical faculty and the scholars. There's a real split. That's fine, you know, they don't agree on anything. You know, that's okay. But what happens is that there's all this bitching and backbiting and nastiness that goes on in the classroom where these people use their students as pawns to get their point of view. You know, that was just so bad what that person did, which I think is just reprehensible. And that's, I mean, and you know, you're gonna find that. I don't know what you can do about that. All I can say is that you have to just navigate your way through like you are walking through a landmine. You know, it's all you can do. And you kind of begin to get a sense of your style, you know, which is how far you're going to go to get along with somebody. You know, how far are you going to bend what your, you know, what your mind is telling you to be a colleague? And it's just a, it's a dance you have to learn to do, but you're protected. See, that's what I love about the Academy. You really are, you know, you really are protected. You have to really show out to not get asked back in, you know, in one sense. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, I think going back to what I said about intellectual freedom, that's absolutely true. I think in companies, if you have an unpopular position, they probably mm-hmm. promote you to get you out of that department. In universities, they don't promote you to get you off their back. But I think one thing you have to be careful about, I think you alluded to this already, the university that you pick, or the department that you pick, actually, even at Michigan, I'm sure there are departments that we wouldn't want to join as faculty members, mm-hmm. even if we were the best researchers, scholars in that area, mm-hmm. we wouldn't want to join. And I hear from my graduate students, you know, several PhD students are now out, you know, in faculty positions, some in industry, and you hear them, when they go to a department, they right away get a sense whether it's a collegial place,
yes.
whether it's a
yes.
nurturing environment.
That's right.
And that really is, goes back to the comment that was made about your interest in teaching, is you have to find the right fit.
Mm-hmm.
If you, and you have to trust your own instincts,
mm-hmm.
that if you don't feel right about a place, it's probably
mm-hmm.
not a right place for you.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, you should heavily depend on your advisor and also other faculty members in your department who are have colleagues in other departments, in other universities, and know a lot.
Right.
And believe it or not, there's a tremendous amount of knowledge that exists about particular environment at these other universities, and you should heavily depend on that information in making a decision where you go. That probably affects your life more than anything else, that first choice that you make in terms of where you're going to end up.
Mm-hmm.
And then after you join a department, I think more senior faculty members, quickly you will realize that respect people who have opinions and who are willing to state their opinions
mm-hmm.
and to defend their case.
Mm-hmm.
You will see that most faculty members are of that line.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you have to be careful not to just go around and piss everybody
We're
off.
We're just alienating
and
people,
and alienate
right.
everybody.
Right.
And pick your fights carefully until you're tenured. And then, and the truth is actually, after you get tenured, I can tell you that with certainty, that you actually even have to be more careful. Because then you have the younger junior faculty members in the department that you have to be careful you're not hurting their feelings and you're not coming across being heavy-handed. And then you have the more senior faculty members that you don't want to give the impression that you've become arrogant just because you've become tenured. So
but really choose where you're going to go carefully, and also pick your fights. That's my best advice.
And you don't have to go to a research institution either. You know, I was thinking about your question. I mean, we have this hierarchical thing in our mind, but you go where you're happy. You know, go to a teacher's college, maybe.
One of my students is doing what you're interested in doing. Bear with me for a minute, and I'll share with you a story. She came to me and she said, you know, I love doing research, but I don't want to spend 100% of my time essentially worrying about research, which is at most research universities, overwhelming majority of our time is spent worrying about research and mentoring graduates. And she said, that's not what I want to do. I want to go to a place that I want to do teaching. And what we did was we sat down and we went through a list of, and the job market for computer scientists is pretty good, so we went through a list of, you know, probably 100 universities that had positions open. And I just essentially helped her eliminate majority of universities that I thought had the culture that did not suit mm-hmm. her interest. Mm-hmm. And I think your advisor or another mentor in a department can be someone you can depend on to help you with that. And that eliminate places that are, you know, are just purely research universities. And you'll be much happier. Mm-hmm. A couple more questions?
Yes, one or two more questions.
Yes.
This is really an extension of the last comment, but I was wondering if you could speak a little more to the pitfalls that await junior faculty members and mistakes that junior faculty members tend to make, especially coming from a large research institution like this one and maybe only having been in that environment and moving to a different kind of institution, say a smaller
mm-hmm.
college but still with
mm-hmm.
a research background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Speak to that.
You know what the biggest mistake I think junior faculty make is not understanding the climate of the department that they are entering. Because junior faculty are always piled up with a lot of work, they're always spinning their wheels and always overworked and underrested. But you might be putting your energy to the wrong thing and not even know it. And so I think the most important thing, the biggest pitfall I think to avoid, is not to be expending all of your energy working for the department, because that's always, you know, you get all the, you know, the committee assignments that nobody else wants, you know, and you know you're directing two plays in your first semester, you know, in my world, and you know, you have, you know, you're asked to take on an overload. Would you mind, you know, teaching four classes? And so you say, oh yes, trying to be, you know, accommodating, you know, and then you find out when you get your first 3-year evaluation, if you're in the tenure stream, if you're on your way to tenure, you find out that this isn't weighted, you know, as much as you thought it was, and this doesn't count at all, and this is really not valued. What he really should have been doing is this, this, and this, and this. And so I would say really get a clear understanding, get it in writing if you can from your chair when you begin a tenure track position, as to really what the department's expectations of you are in your first year, and get a clear understanding that at your 3-year review, if there is such a thing, if there isn't such a thing, can I in fact have an informal 3-year review where we sit down together and we look back over the 3 years and you tell me what my strengths are from the department's point of view and what my weaknesses are, what you'd like to see me strengthen, what you'd like to see me improve in my next 3 years. Then you have some protection if you're denied tenure. You have some protection because you have this document that says these were the things that I was told to work on and I did, and this is how you document. Yeah, I published 5 articles. I have my book coming out. I, you know, sat on 3, you know, scholarly journals or whatever. So that's what I would think. That clear understanding of what the expectations are, and don't let yourself get overworked if it's not going to directly enhance your tenure portfolio. If it's something you want to do that is not valued, find a way to get it valued. You know, find a way to get it and get it in writing.
I think the biggest pitfall for junior faculty members is that you have to be careful. You want to be a good citizen, but don't overdo it.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the bottom line, because
mm-hmm.
there will be so many requests. If you are, particularly if you're conscientious, you do a good job
mm-hmm.
serving on a committee,
mm-hmm.
there'll be half a dozen other committees that will pop up and will require your attention, and everybody will
mm-hmm.
swear that it is, you know, the thing to do.
Yeah.
How do you say no?
Oh, you just draw the line. And what you do is, a good department, when you approach them, we do this in ACS. With, first of all, junior faculty members the first 2 years are given no official service assignment.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask your department when you go visit and ask them, in fact, you should come up with a list of questions.
Right.
Getting a job is a different issue we're not addressing here today. But you, that's one of the questions you should ask is, what kind of service do you expect from junior faculty members?
Mm-hmm.
And your expectation should be that the first couple of years, you do absolutely nothing but focus on your research and your teaching. That's
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, you essentially have to politely learn to say no, and even better, to go to your department head and get them to say no for you.
Right.
Or another senior faculty members to
right.
draw the line. Because that is probably the biggest pitfalls that I've seen among junior faculty members. They just get swamped with,
afraid,
you know,
to say no.
Yeah, don't be afraid of that.
Right.
Because
and the thing to do is say, you know, I would love to, it sounds so exciting, blah, 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 but I have a deadline for an article that I must get out. You know, always couch it in terms of your research. You know, never couch it in terms of, oh, I have to go see, you know, the premiere of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I have tickets. You know, always couch it, though, in terms of your research so that the only perception that person can have is that you're trying to stay on your publication, you know, path.
We have a last quick, relatively quick one.
Yeah.
How many people don't?
You know, I was very shocked. I don't know what your experience has been. I was really shocked when I find out how many people go all the way up through those 7 years and they do not get tenured. I mean, I was really shocked when I began. And you can't see why. You know, it's like you just simply cannot please some institutions. You know, you can't. They've done everything. They've published. And then, but, they're, you know, it's just not seen good enough. And it's not, you know, prestigious enough. And it's just not fit enough. So I would say, I don't know any statistics, maybe... maybe some of my colleagues do, but I would say a lot.
Wait,
I would say like half.
Is that a fair question to ask a search committee? What percent of...
Sure. Actually,
that's a wonderful question to ask a search committee.
Yeah, actually, ask the, not just the search committee, ask various faculty members, ask the dean. And here's the reason you should ask it. In fact, a lot of universities, when you go for an interview, they tell you that, wow, we're a very tough place. We
mm-hmm.
only tenure, you know, half of our people or
mm-hmm.
a quarter of our people.
Mm-hmm.
That actually shows it's a pretty lousy institution.
Yes.
Because they're doing two things. One of the two things wrong. One, either they're real turkeys. They don't know what kind of faculty members to recruit. They're
mm-hmm.
terrible recruiters
mm-hmm.
because they obviously have gone, and 75% of the time they
right.
recruited other turkeys that
right.
they're not willing to.
Right.
Or, right? I mean, that's the other possibility. Or the second possibility is that their attitude toward tenure is, we bring people in, we let them hang around, we
yeah.
don't nurture them.
Don't nurture them,
and if
right.
they don't nurture them, it's sort of survival of the fittest
right.
mentality.
That's what it
and
is.
And then if they survive, we know they're good enough for us. If they don't survive, well, somebody else will take
we'll
them.
Come
or they
along,
go
yeah.
So that's exact. You want to go to an institution that's proud of the fact that their tenure rate
yes.
is very high.
That's right. That's
and,
right.
And, you know, you know the reputation of institution. There are some institutions like Harvard in computer
yeah.
science, they just don't tenure anybody.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that. So when
yeah.
you're going in, you know that you're going to go in, you're going to spend 7 years there, you're not going to get tenure, but then you turn around and enter, say, Illinois or Michigan
right.
or Wisconsin as
right.
a tenured faculty. That's kind of an unwritten rule. We all know that it happens and
right.
so on. And some people, it really does happen to them, and most people, you know, they go through the tenure process, don't get a job somewhere else.
That's right.
But really, the thing you need to ask, I don't know what the statistics are. I am sure it varies from college to college, university to university.
Right.
But the thing you need to ask is, well, what is your rate of tenure? In EECS department last night, this came up actually last night because I was having dinner with a faculty candidate who brought up this issue. My department head said, and he said, 11 people came up for promotion and tenure last year
mm-hmm.
from our department.
Mm-hmm.
Out of 11, 10 got it, and the only person who did not get it was a promotion from associate to full.
Mm-hmm.
That was considered to be delayed.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else who came up for tenure and promotion,
mm-hmm.
and my department head was very happy
mm-hmm.
to say that, and he was very proud of that track record.
Mm-hmm.
That we,
yeah, that's right.
You know,
it's very important that the institution that you apply to and are finally align yourself with is a nurturing institution, because there are a lot of institutions who have the attitude that my colleague says, well, we'll hire you, you know, and you're out there on your own, no guidance, and if you can get through us, then you deserve tenure, and if you can't, you know, so what? And nobody can succeed in that situation, and nobody should have to, and nobody should want to. So the important thing is to ask the right questions. I think a great workshop
would be questions to ask on your interviews when you're going to interview for your first tenure track.
There's
position.
Stuff online and the web available, actually.
Oh.
There are people who have put stuff like this together. My students have tracked them down. And there's stuff that they're available that it's maybe particular to engineering discipline, I'm not sure. But I know my student was telling me, because I go over a list of questions that they should be asking and so on. And she had a list of like 100 questions she had come up with that she found online. Search for it. If you can't find it, send me an email. I'll find it.
So there was a workshop like that.
Yeah.
Right? You
we've had some
acted
not quite
as
that
a
specific,
interview
but we've covered that. We also have a couple resources in our library that would have some typical questions as well. So I know that we're impinging on Professor Jahanian's dinner hour.
Oh,
I do want to thank the panelists again for coming out.
Thank you.
If a couple of minutes to fill out those evaluations, I would appreciate it.
You didn't tell us that we were
going to
be
an
object.
Oh,
that
sure.
Was really helpful.
Good.